Big controversy today over diet advice. A report by the National Obesity Forum has suggested eating fat could help cut obesity and type 2 diabetes. But that has been condemned as irresponsible and potentially deadly by the chief nutritionist in the English Health Service. By coincidence, Northern Ireland's Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Michael McBride, has his annual report published today, dealing with a range of key issues, including obesity. Dr. McBride is with us now. Michael, good morning to you.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. We'll talk about that other National Obesity Forum take on things later. I want to talk about your report, first of all. There's an emphasis on lifestyle, isn't there, and how we can very much affect our own health by our lifestyle.
There is, Stephen. I think that we all know how important the quality of healthcare is in Northern Ireland to determine good health, but also the choices that we make, the lifestyle choices that we make, make a fundamental difference in terms of our general health. How much physical exercise we choose to take, how much we eat, whether we consume alcohol or not, whether we smoke or not, and all of these things are choices which, through our responsibility working in health, is to raise awareness, to educate, and where necessary, to legislate to make sure that we make it easier for people to make the right choices. Now, that's not to minimise how difficult some of those things are, particularly when we're talking about physical activity, when we're talking about exercise, or we're talking about kicking a lifetime addictive habit like smoking or reducing our alcohol consumption.
Yeah, but we're not robots, and I guess some people think life ain't worth living if you're going to walk around eating like a rabbit all day.
No, we're not, and I think that's why it's important this year. I mean, myself and my counterparts, the four UK CMOs, issued evidence-based guidance on alcohol, the most up-to-date guidance that there is around levels of alcohol that will reduce our risk of the harm caused by alcohol, making clear that there is no safe level of alcohol to consume. And we also, and we produce that in a very clear and a very comprehensive way, and we also produce guidance to the public in a very clear infogram around levels of physical activity and the 2.5 hours per week that we should all be aiming to take. So getting information and up-to-date and evidence-based information to inform choices is important, and it's important that we support people in terms of what we do to the general build environment, our work encouraging active travel, and how we as a society across government departments and working with other stakeholders are making it easier for the population to do the right thing and make the right choices.
You say in your report that the new weekly guideline is that we shouldn't be drinking more than 6 pints of beer or 6 glasses of wine. Of course, some people have that in half a night.
I mean, that's true. And I think that the reality is that the new evidence, and don't forget that this is the most up-to-date evidence anywhere in the world. This is 2 years of work. This is the best scientific researchers and epidemiologists looking at the global evidence, commissioning new research in the United Kingdom. And increasingly what we now know about alcohol is that there is no safe limit of alcohol to consume, particularly because of the links to certain forms of cancer. Now, we know that you can reduce the risks, the lifetime risks of consuming alcohol to less than 1% if indeed you consume less than 14 units per week. But you're absolutely correct that some people will look at this information and will choose to consume more alcohol than that. Now, that's personal choice. But for some, however, it isn't just personal choice. For some individuals who are addicted to alcohol, it's important that we have the right support and treatment services in place.
And there's a link, Michael, between alcohol and cancer, is there?
All of the latest evidence shows that there's a significant link between consumption of alcohol and various forms of cancer, gastrointestinal cancers, that's cancers of the gut, cancers of the liver, cancers of the mouth, etc. So that is an emerging evidence base. We also know that with the reductions and a very significant improvement to the health of the population that we've achieved with reductions in heart disease, that this old adage, you know, a glass of wine a day is good for your heart, isn't simply true. So if someone out there is thinking of taking up drinking alcohol to protect their heart, don't. Alcohol, all levels of consumption carry with it at risk. And the other important message we put out into the public domain, particularly for women who are pregnant or planning pregnancy, is that the safest option is not to consume alcohol at all.
I read that. So for those mothers who do consume alcohol, What possible dangers are they presenting to their baby? What does the research show happens to the baby?
Well, one of the most profound impacts of alcohol, particularly if women are drinking significant amounts of alcohol during pregnancy, is fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And that is a condition that can have profound long-term effects for the baby in terms of particular facial characteristics, learning and educational difficulties and challenges, behavior problems and challenges, and certainly can result in a lifetime of problems for their child. So it is important. Now, this isn't about scaremongering. It is just making ensure that we put informed information, evidence-based information, into the public domain so people can make the right choice.
Is it, in your view, irresponsible for a mother to consume alcohol when pregnant?
That's not a matter for me to comment on. My role as chief medical officer is to say that the safest message for women who are pregnant or are planning pregnancy is not to consume alcohol.
It's your role to give advice. And for example, you're pretty, you don't really mince your words when you talk about people who smoke in cars around children, and the dangers that presents. I'm trying to get a feel for just how dangerous it is for those mothers to think, well, for goodness sake, I'm only having, you know, a few units a week or whatever. What's your view?
Well, what you're asking me to be judgmental, and I won't be judgmental about individuals or individual behaviours. All I can do as chief medical officer is put the evidence out there in terms of the potential harm to unborn babies through as a result of alcohol consumption in pregnancy. And the evidence is that there is no safe level of alcohol to consume in pregnancy.
So don't do it.
And that's the message in the guidance, which is that if you're planning pregnancy or pregnant, the safest approach is not to consume alcohol during the pregnancy. And we know, for instance, that the vast majority of women don't drink alcohol during pregnancy at all, or indeed significantly reduce their alcohol consumption in pregnancy. But it is important that we provide the most up-to-date information and advice to the public so that we can continue to see the improvements in health that we're seeing. We're all living longer, and the report shows that from 1991, each man in Northern Ireland has gained 3 months of life per year, every single year. Each woman has gained 2 months of life each and every single year from 1991. We still have significant gaps in terms of those who live in more disadvantaged areas, in terms
exactly.
of more affluent areas. And those are issues which we continually need to address.
And that health equality gap, as we describe it, spell that out to us.
Well, I mean, the stark fact of the matter is that if you're a male living in one of the 20% most deprived areas, your life expectancy is 7.4 years less. Seven years less if you live in a more deprived area. And if you're female, it's 4 years of life that you lose. Now, if you even then look at healthy life expectancy, that's a measure of us living without any long-term health conditions or sickness or ill health. We know that all of us can expect to live about three-quarters of our life in good health. We're living longer, and we can expect to live three-quarters of our life in good health. But if we actually look at women in the most disadvantaged area, they become unwell and suffer from health problems 14 years earlier than those in the least deprived areas. And for men, the figure is close to 12 years. So that's if you take a man in a deprived area, that's 12 years of good health that they don't have compared to someone who is living in a less socially disadvantaged part of Northern Ireland.
And do we know why? What is happening in these deprived areas?
Well,
is it diet or what is it?
Well, it's a whole combination of factors, and the factors are complex. And that's why, through the executive's new public health framework, Making Life Better, why it requires action across government. It requires action across all sectors to ensure that we create the circumstances in those communities where those individuals are afforded the same life opportunities as everyone else. So it's got everything to do from education to employment opportunities to the social and economic circumstances in those environments, and all of those then translating into poorer health outcomes.
Yeah, but what needs to be done? So it is quite a stark statistic. A child born in Northern Ireland today, growing up in a deprived area, is likely to live 7 years less than someone in a more affluent area. So what precisely needs to be done? Have we worked that out yet?
Well, there, again, it requires concerted, coordinated action, as I said, at all across government levels. So, for instance, let's take those children living in those communities. It's important that through the work that we're doing by our public health agency, the early years program, there's a real emphasis on the new public health framework and the 0 to 3 year olds. So to make sure that every child in Northern Ireland has the best start in life possible. That includes very basic things such as reading to a child. It includes the relationship between between a parent and parents and that child. It includes giving that, making sure that that child is school ready. It means ensuring that we're supporting and encouraging those child to achieve their best possible educational attainment. It means working with those communities to ensure that we are creating the job opportunities, and indeed that we're doing the most that we can to improve the social circumstances in which those children live.
And is that a quality gap getting worse or better?
It's remaining unchanged, sadly. I think that...
Well, that's a failure of government, isn't it?
Well, I think... You know, I think it's very easy to say it's a failure of government. I think we are no different. This isn't a made in Northern Ireland problem. We are no different, regrettably, than other parts of the United Kingdom, no different than other parts of the world, that disadvantage, social and economic disadvantage, translates into poorer health outcomes in terms of reduced life expectancy and reduced years lived well. And it's complex, and that's why we need coordinated action across government, and that's why the Making Life Better public health framework and the next programme for government are so crucially important in continuing the work that the all departments are doing and the executives doing in this area.
Self-harming is... The statistic there really shocked me this morning, and these figures were for April 2013 to March 2014. That's the latest figures that... are included in your report around this area. And you say that there were 8,500 self-harm cases to NE, the majority of them 15 to 24-year-olds.
Yes, I think that it is a worrying statistic. I think that, and it's important that as we're doing that, we will, whilst raising the awareness of the challenge of this, that we also discuss it in a sensitive and proportionate way. We need to reassure individuals who are self-harming and their parents and their carers that there is support out there, there are services out there coordinated by our public health agency, available in all health and social care trusts, working in partnership with community counselling organisations. But it is a disturbing fact. As a matter of fact, the WHO has commended the registry in Northern Ireland because it isn't something that's uniformly in place across other parts of the United Kingdom. It will and does provide us information. Now, this is the... We piloted it first in the Western Trust back in 2007. We've extended it in 2012 across all trusts in Northern Ireland. And it allows us to monitor trends and patterns, even though we've not only just now got to our second year of full data at a Northern Ireland level. But it really what it's about is about allowing us to better understand the scale and extent of the problem and to better tailor support service and advice services for those young people, those 15 to 24-year-olds, in the main, who make up about 44% of those who are self-farming, and also provide appropriate support to their parents and carers. That's why our public health agency ran a major event in this back in 2015, a support event for our parents, and why they have put specialists in training into 29 trainers across all our health and social care trusts to cascade training to staff in our emergency department, so that people, when they present, are treated sensitively, and that we're identifying those who are repeatedly self-harming into support services that are appropriate to their needs.
Yeah, 20% of people who self-harmed had done it before. There is a Northern Ireland factor here, or at least the data which you publish in your report would suggest that's the case. So there is double the amount of people. We're talking about incident rate per 100,000 here. Of rate of self-harm for people aged 15 and over, Dr. McBride, and more than double the amount of people self-harm in Derry than do in Oxford, more than double the amount of people, nearly double the amount of people self-harm in Derry than do in Dublin. What on earth is going on? Well, similar figures for Belfast. If we compare Belfast to Manchester, It's about 70-80% higher in Belfast than it is in Manchester, and nearly double. Belfast is nearly double what it is in Dublin. So that,
I think what's going on?
Two hours down the road in a drive to Dublin, and the rate of self-harm halves. What is it about Northern Irish society?
And I think that's why we this data is so important for us to understand and seek to provide better support and care and treatment for individuals who are self-harming. We need to understand what are the underlying factors that are fueling this. We obviously need to bear in mind that there are differences in the health service in the Republic of Ireland compared to Northern Ireland, and people are charged a fee if they don't have a medical card presenting in an emergency department. So that may be a factor, and that point is made in the report. We also, as I said earlier, need to bear in mind that we don't have comprehensive data for the rest of the United Kingdom to do comparative analysis. But there is no doubt that if one looks at incidents of self-harm and suicidal ideation, because we know there's a link between self-harm and suicidal ideation, particularly in those who repeatedly self-harm, that that does point to the challenges in wider society in Northern Ireland in terms of addressing mental health challenges. Now, that's not to suggest that everyone who self-harms has an underlying psychiatric condition, but clearly those individuals are suffering from significant emotional distress. And there may be many factors involved in that. It may well be bullying. It may well be victimization. It may be, but it is some form of pressure those individuals are experiencing that is resulting in them engaging in this sort of behavior. And it's only by understanding this better and making this a priority in our new Protect Life strategy, which will go out for public consultation in the summer, subject to consideration by the minister, that we will really begin to make an impact on the mental health, well-being and emotional resilience of the population in Northern Ireland.
It's often said that there may be a legacy of the troubles factor in this, but the majority of people who were self-harming were aged 15 to 24. So I'm just stretching here to understand why there would be this particular problem in Northern Ireland, and we can't really link it to a legacy factor if it's 15 to 24-year-olds.
Well, again, we're into, as you say, we need to be cautious in terms of what we know and what we don't know, and extrapolation and conjecture is obviously risky, and as you quite rightly point out. But let's bear in mind that young people growing up, 15 to 24-year-olds, are still growing up in a society that's living in the aftermath of the troubles and its consequences. Some are still growing up in communities where community violence linked to the troubles is still prevalent. Some are still subject to the impact of that. We know that the demand on our mental health services here in Northern Ireland is 25% greater than other parts of the United Kingdom. We know from research carried out in Queen's University that a significant amount of the burden on our mental health services is a consequence of the troubles. So we are a society, like it or not, that is coming out of conflict. And we know the impact that has on rates of people who die as a consequence of suicide in Northern Ireland. And indeed, the consequences that we are seeing in terms of our high prevalence of individuals who engage in self-harm may be partly related to that. And I think the honest answer is, Stephen, that's why this data is so important, because what it does, it asks and causes us to ask deep, searching questions about what we can do to address the root causes of this this behaviour.
If our figure is 25% higher than elsewhere in the UK, here in Northern Ireland, are we investing 25% more into mental health support? Are we investing more at all?
Well, I don't have those figures to hand. We spend about 12% or so of our total health budget in mental health services. I think there's questions we always need to ask ourselves in terms of, now we spend £4.8 billion on health in Northern Ireland each year. We have to continually ask ourselves questions, are we spending that money as efficiently and effectively as we can? And if there are, if there is a case for additional resources, we will make that case for additional resources. I think that there is no doubt that there are pressures on our mental health services. There are pressures on mental health services right across the United Kingdom. And I think that we need to, as we have been, very actively changing the model of mental health care delivery in Northern Ireland. We have moved from a model which is largely, certainly for those with acute mental health conditions, inpatient-based, to one which is outpatient-based, supporting people to live at home in their communities, home support teams. So we're providing that service in a very innovative and different way, and also in a way that makes more effective use of resource.
So I understand if you don't have the precise figures, but are we prioritising mental health?
Well, we have been providing, you know, since the Bamford Review now almost some 10 years ago, which made fundamental recommendations in relation to mental health and learning disability, the people living with a learning disability, we are prioritising mental health and learning disability. Is there more we could do? Yes, of course, there's more that we could do. Is there more there should be doing? Yes, there is. And I think it's in all of this, it's always a case of balancing the, at times, competing priorities that we see for mental health services. But also, if I might add, Stephen, it's important that we get upstream of this. You know, we can spend a huge amount of our time and resource and energy dealing with the consequences of poor mental health, or we can get upstream of this. We can get into our schools, as we've been doing, working with the Department of Education, working with ourselves in health, to get a mental health and well-being, emotional resilience program in our schools, so we equip young people with the life skills to manage the pressures and the huge and significant pressures they experience growing up in modern-day society, that they establish the support networks, that we provide for them information about the services that they can ask and signpost them to those. And that is a much more effective way of building resilience and preventing the downstream consequence of poor mental health. Of course, we have to do both simultaneously. But again, that's the approach that's likely to be effective in the longer term.
One of the realities of all of this, and we've touched upon it just a couple more minutes and we're done, we've touched upon it a number of times during this interview, is the prioritisation of funding. And you know, you would like to do everything, but you've got a finite pot of money. That's the reality, which we understand. What type of budget pressures are there on the health service as you look forward to the next 5 years? Have you got enough money? Of course, you could always want more, but have you got enough?
Well, again, you know, Stephen, as Chief Medical Officer, those aren't matters for myself around the budget, or those decisions are made around the executive table. They're made by the Department of Finance and working with the executive ministers in terms of the budget allocation. I think our responsibility is within health, and indeed within all other departments, is to make sure that we're making every pound count. We spend, you know, 4.8 billion pounds a year on health and social care in Northern Ireland. That is a huge sum of money, representing some 42% of the Northern Ireland bloc. It is incumbent upon us to make sure that we're using that money as efficiently and effectively as we possibly can.
Yeah, but what you can do is, Dr. McBride, you can feed in or help to feed into a discussion that we are all having as a society. I was presenting a similar programme on Five Live in England just last week on this. That we as a society need to determine whether we're prepared to either pay more because the health service needs more as we're growing older, as people like you and your incredible doctors and nurses and the incredible job they do keep us alive for longer. Is the model working as it currently stands with the funding you've got, or are we looking at a particular stage where we need a discussion that something needs to fundamentally change?
Well, do things fundamentally need to change? Yes. I mean, my report last year, I did say slow and no are not options in terms of the reconfiguration, remodelling of health and social care in Northern Ireland. We had this in Shirlane Donaldson's report indicating that change in terms of how we deliver health and social care services in Northern Ireland was a priority.
I'm talking about the funding.
Well, what I'm talking about is actually using that funding effectively. Because I think that's the first starting place. Before we make a case for additional funds, we need to be absolutely certain that we're maximising the £4.8 billion that we have. So Sir Liam Donaldson in his report said that we need to remodel and reconfigure how we're providing services. That's why the then Minister appointed an expert panel led by Professor Rafa Bengoa to lead that work around Recommendation 1 of Sir Liam Donaldson's report. That report, I suspect, will be challenging. I suspect it will make far-reaching proposals in terms of how we need to configure services to do several things: to improve the health of the population, to ensure that we're providing the best quality of care that we possibly can and the best experience of care, and to use our resources as effectively as we can. I think that's the conversation that we need to have, a conversation that is not about money, but is about fundamentally how we improve the quality and experience of the service that every citizen in Northern Ireland deserves and should expect.
And two more minutes, I promise we're done. It's really interesting, all of this. In terms of the experiences of patients, do you feel any sense of frustration as the man who's the chief medical officer in Northern Ireland as to the dire waiting lists that some people are experiencing here in Northern Ireland? Some people waiting a year to see a consultant. It's disgraceful, isn't it?
I think that the length of time that some people are having to wait for routine procedures, waiting at home, waiting sometimes with significant pain and discomfort, is not something that I look to with any sense of satisfaction. I don't think that any of us working in health and social care are responsible for the system can look to that. We have made significant improvements over the last quarter as a result of additional investment that was secured. We need to further improve waiting times, significantly improve waiting times in some areas.
Are we going to do that?
It will require, and again, it's linked back to my earlier point, it is only when we begin to use the resource that we have effectively and have an informed, mature discussion and debate about what services need to be provided where and what actually doesn't need to be provided in a local area. We need to ensure that we're keeping services that can be local, those services that need to be centralised, so that we can actually effectively use the resource and ensure that we're using that resource to address the intolerable situation where some people are waiting excessive periods of time for access to treatment and care. We are making progress in that area. I think we need to make more progress more quickly, and I think that I don't think you would get anyone working within the health and social care sector that would not say so.
But just on that, is it not true that funding for the private health sector, which has helped to reduce waiting lists, has been turned off again?
Well, we were the department received money which it put into both in-house activity, so it's not just all in the independent sector, into in-house activity in the health service to ensure that we had additional capacity to treat people who were waiting the longest, and we also used the independent sector. All of those individuals who had been offered a treatment or a review will be followed through.
Yeah, but I'm talking about now, that extra funding for the private health sector, it's been turned off again, hasn't it?
Well, I mean, it's up to us now as a department, and obviously as chief medical officer, I don't manage the money. But just a general comment, it's up for us in health to make sure that we're using the money as effectively as we can, and that's back to Sir Liam Donaldson's report.
But am I right in saying that the funding's been turned off?
And it's up to us to make the case for additional funds. But in terms of the monies that were provided previously, we no longer have those additional monies to continue to provide the additional activity. But we will be making a robust case for securing additional resource to ensure that we maintain progress on reducing waiting times. Because again,
I want to push you one more time, because it is a yes or a no. Has the funding been turned off again to the private health sector?
Well, we had a sum of money which we have spent, and indeed we have identified some priorities for next year in terms of spending to maintain that downward pressure on waiting times, and we will be making a case. But the money that we had, we did spend.
All of it?
I don't have those details, Stephen. I really don't.
A source told me that because of the timing of the funding, and just to explain to people, this money was given to the private health sector to reduce waiting lists. That was why it was given, to help to reduce waiting lists. And because of the timing of when the money need to be spent, a source told me that actually all of that money hadn't been spent because they couldn't do it in time, because they were only getting the patients' names and details weeks before the money had to be spent, and therefore some of that money was handed back. Do you know if that's accurate?
Well, Stephen, you know, I don't know your source, and I can't comment on your comment. I don't have those details.